Washington. This is Daybreak Asia. Good morning. I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, the search for missing Malaysian plane remains frustrating. We begin a series investigating ways to make plane travel safer. Chinese human rights record under UN scrutiny. These stories and more on this Thursday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Frustration over the lack of progress in the search for a missing Malaysia Airlines jet erupted Wednesday at a daily news conference where Chinese relatives of missing passengers confronted Malaysian officials. The grieving families burst into the room where the media briefing was to be held, yelling and holding a banner demanding Malaysia tell the truth about what happened to the plane that has been missing since March 8th. Two-thirds of the plane's 227 passengers were Chinese. Many of their families have become increasingly angry about what they feel is contradictory and confusing information released by Malaysia. Once the news conference began, Malaysian Defense Minister Hushamuddin Hussein said authorities are trying to do their very best to locate the plane and to narrow the search area, which now covers more than 7 million square kilometers. Malaysia's government says the disappearance of the Malaysia Airlines jet was the result of a deliberate action by a person or persons in command of the plane. Many people believe that deliberate action was an unprecedented type of hijacking or commandeering of a Boeing 777 airliner for unlawful purposes. Investigators have not yet ruled out other motives for the diversion of the plane from its intended Kuala Lumpur to Beijing route before the aircraft vanished. Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin has been investigating what the aviation industry and governments can do to try to prevent similar disappearances of passenger planes in the future. He spoke with Hans Weber, president of TechOp International, a consulting company focused on aviation safety and security issues. Weber talked about two technological improvements that he believes could address security issues highlighted by Flight MH370.
This plane met all the latest requirements, and it is protected against the outside terrorist job, somebody breaking into the cockpit and commandeering the airplane. And the primary protection against that is the reinforced cockpit door. So if it was commandeered from the outside, then that indicates that the protective measure, which primarily relies on the reinforced cockpit door, was insufficient. But it's also the procedures that an airline uses when pilots have to exit the cockpit to go to the bathroom, or flight attendants enter the cockpit to serve coffee or something to eat. And depending on how sloppy or how good the airline is with its procedures, those could be very significant moments of vulnerability. There have been proposals made for some time that there should be a second cockpit door so that the intruders could not take advantage of this dangerous, of this vulnerable moment. You know, it's easier to overcome a flight attendant as the flight attendant enters the cockpit than it is to break through a door. So that's an improvement that I'm sure is going to be now very seriously debated. It has been debated for, I would say, a couple of years at least, with waxing and waning intensity. And it always failed because the question was, well, how much more money do we want to spend? How much weight do we want to put on the airplane, etc.? I'm sure this debate will really revive.
If there is a second door, how could a second door be any less vulnerable to being, you know, barged into than the first door?
Well, there are several aspects to this answer. Now, the first aspect is that the second door would be placed in such a way that you close it and then the pilots would have a secure path to the bathroom. Number two, breaching the outer door first causes commotion that increases the time the pilots have to do something. You know, what can they do? Well, you know, they could put the plane into violent maneuvers to get the terrorists off their feet. And above all, they can communicate. They can radio the situation. So that would give them a few seconds, which would be sufficient to communicate that they were being commandeered. That would be crucial so that you know that you have some good information as to where they were when that happened and that they were being commandeered.
Have any airlines introduced such doors yet, as far as you know?
No airline has introduced those doors. But as I said, there has been a vigorous discussion on the pros and cons and the costs, et cetera, of that door. Now, inside job What do you do against an inside job? I mean, the pilot has the fate of the plane in his hands. The captain is in command of the aircraft. And if the captain wants to destroy the aircraft or commandeer it, there is really almost nothing that can prevent it from doing this. There is one thing, however, that was very much debated and proposed in the aftermath of September 11th, and that is to have the airplane taken over remotely and flown remotely. Now, in 2001, the technology to do that, to remotely pilot an airplane and safely land it, was in its infancy compared to the status it is in today. You know, technology has greatly advanced, what with many unmanned aerial vehicles. And the idea here is that if the plane senses that there's something wrong, which could be that the flight plan is altered without having gotten permission from flight control. I mean, the normal procedure is pilot gets permission from flight control. Without that, if the flight plan is altered, that would be a sign that the airplane has been commandeered, in which case all controls inside the airplane would be deactivated. The pilots could no longer maintain control of the aircraft, and the airplane would be remotely piloted to an airport. Now, that's technically feasible these days. For some years now, there have been very serious considerations given, especially by cargo airlines, as to what it would take to fly pilotless airplanes and what would be involved. The airplane would have to be configured in such a way that when you throw that switch from pilot control to remote control, then you deactivate all internal controls, all circuit breakers, everything, so that the pilots cannot pull a circuit breaker that would deactivate an important part of this remote control.
I would imagine that there might be some resistance from pilots to the idea of putting a system in place in which their control over the plane is completely taken away under certain circumstances. What do you think about those kinds of concerns?
Well, those concerns are very valid, in my opinion. You see, any system, no matter what it is, can fail. And that's a real pilot concern and a fear that here all of a sudden their system fails, takes control away from them, and they're helpless. And the system might crash the airplane. What can you do about it? You see, there are things you can do. If the pilots are still available, they can still radio. I mean, you wouldn't cut off the radio communication. So they can still call air traffic control, call the dispatcher, issue a mayday signal that, help, our airplane has been taken over by the remote control computer. And there's nothing wrong. This must be a system failure. And so they should be able to restore control back to the pilots. So that's a valid concern. However, there seems to be an answer to it, as just described.
Hans Weber is an aviation safety consultant with TechOp International. He was speaking with Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin, who joins us again tomorrow to explore more ways to make air travel safer. Our weekly poll at voanews.com/Daybreak Asia is currently asking, where do you think Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 will be found? As of today, Thursday, the choices are interestingly evening out. So far, and down again as opinions are shifting, 34% of those responding think the plane will be found in the ocean. Up to 20%, those of you who responded say the plane ended up on an island. Another 20% are looking at a location toward inland Asia, and also up, 17% say the plane will never be found, while almost 8% are not sure. It's not a scientific poll, but an interesting reflection of what you and the rest of our audience is thinking, as nearly 2 weeks have passed in the search for Malaysian Airlines 370. You may make your choice both at our VOA Asia Facebook page and at voanews.com/Daybreak Asia. Days after China dismissed a United Nations report that accused North Korea of crimes against humanity, Beijing is criticizing a UN investigative report on its own human rights record. The report is scheduled to be adopted by the world body in Geneva and is the outcome of months of dialogue between UN member states and the Chinese government. Rebecca Valley has more from Hong Kong.
The Universal Periodic Review is a UN mechanism that examines the human rights record of member countries with the help of other member states and independent groups. The inquiry covers a wide range of issues. In its response to the report on its own human rights record, Beijing accepted 204 of the recommendations on issues ranging from poverty alleviation to a stronger welfare system. But on other issues, such as China's policies in Tibet, judicial reform, and treatment of political opposition, authorities rejected the recommendations. Hong Lei, a spokesman for China's foreign ministry, spoke to reporters in Beijing Wednesday. At the UN Human Rights Council, some countries ignored the great progress made by China on human rights and willfully criticized, he said. This is the politicization of human rights and the double standard. China rejected the report's advice on 48 points, either dismissing the relevancy of the issues raised or claiming that it is already implementing laws to better protect its citizens' rights. Ye Shiwei of the advocacy group Human Rights in China says the recent crackdown on human rights defenders in China belies the government's reassurances to the United Nations.
We really need to ask China, if they're already doing that, then why are there so many people in the New Citizens Movement and in other human rights communities in China? And of course, Cao Shunli herself, why she died.
Cao Shunli was an activist who had been staging peaceful sit-ins to press Chinese authorities to allow independent groups to participate in the UN's review. In September, she was arrested by police at the airport before she could participate in meetings in Geneva. Authorities later said she died while in custody. A group of human rights experts at the UN, as well as some countries involved in the review, urged the Chinese government to investigate Cao's death. They say it is unacceptable that activists pay the ultimate price for interacting with the United Nations on human rights. In recent months, China has put on trial members of the New Citizen Movement, a loosely organized group that advocates for anti-discrimination policies and political accountability. Human Rights in China's Ye Shiwei says that Cao's treatment and the intense crackdown on political dissent has heavily weighed on the review.
In 2009, at the review, only two countries have raised the issue of protecting civil society, whereas in 2013, at least 13 countries have raised it.
Through the Universal Periodic Review, several countries urged China to ratify the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which includes protecting freedom of speech and association and guaranteeing a fair trial. China says it's adjusting its legal system in ways that will address some of these issues, but says it has not set a timetable for formally implementing the international treaty. In response to criticism of its policies on ethnic and religious minorities, China said the government guarantees the protection of all the basic rights of minorities. In Tibet, more than 130 people have self-immolated since 2009, in protest of China's heavy policing of the region and oppression of religious rights. All but one of the UN Review's recommendations on Tibet were rejected by China, which only agreed to facilitate visits to Tibet by senior UN officials. Rebecca Valli in Hong Kong for VOA.
U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama arrives in China today for a six-day visit, along with her daughters and mother. White House officials say the trip will focus largely on education, cross-cultural ties, and empowering youth. VOA's Bill Ide has more on how the trip is being anticipated in Beijing.
Even before Ms. Obama arrived in Beijing, Chinese state media reports were emphasizing the visit, calling it a sequel to last year's informal get-together in Sunnylands, California, between President Barack Obama and China's Xi Jinping. The first day of her trip will be spent with her Chinese counterpart in Beijing, Mr. Xi's wife and First Lady Peng Liyuan. The two will visit a school and the Forbidden City. They will also attend a performance after dinner. The capital's popular Beijing News talked about how First Lady diplomacy could play a unique role in U.S.-China relations. It also remarked how the trip is in sharp contrast to what it called double standards of U.S. cooperation in the field of counterterrorism and the lack of trust over territorial disputes in the East and South China Sea. The article said Ms. Obama would be visiting when there are not any immediate frictions in areas such as human rights. However, just last week, Chinese rights activist Cao Shunli died after falling critically ill in prison. A UN investigative report on China's human rights record is scheduled to be adopted by the world body in Geneva Wednesday. The visit also comes just days after two more Tibetan monks set themselves on fire in protest of Chinese rule. Despite their differences, China and the United States are trying to build a new type of relationship, one between great nations. Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei says both sides see the trip as contributing to that effort. Hong says the trip is being made when the two countries are building a new model of country relations, adding, it is of great significance to the relationship between the two countries. The Beijing Youth Daily highlighted how education is expected to be a focus of the trip, with visits to three schools, including Peking University. Ms. Obama's chief of staff, Tina Chun, says that during the trip, the First Lady will be focusing on the power of technology and her own story,
which we think resonates with young people around the world. How someone from a modest background whose parents didn't go to college but who emphasized education always to the First Lady and her brother, encouraged them to use education as a way to succeed and move forward.
Ms. Obama will stay in Beijing until Sunday, visit the Great Wall, other attractions, and deliver a speech at Peking University's Stanford Center, among other activities. On Monday, the First Lady, her daughters, and mother travel on to Xi'an to visit China's Xi'an City Wall and Chengdu. Although the trip has been tightly scripted, it is still possible that sensitive issues could arise. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Follow First Lady Michelle Obama's trip to China with us on our program page at voanews.com/daybreakasia. You can like us on our VOA Asia Facebook page, and we're available through the VOA app for your mobile phone and on Twitter, where you can follow me at VOA Stevenson. More than 5,000 Chinese national lawmakers and political advisors have concluded annual meetings in Beijing to discuss policies and develop proposals to help advance the world's second-largest economy. The main theme focused on deepening political reforms. The government work report by Premier Li Keqiang referred to reforms 77 times. Who are all these leaders, and how do they approach governing in China? David Lampton is professor of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies at SAIS. His new book, Following the Leader, is in part culled from 558 interviews with various Chinese leaders, the notes of which had been stored away for some time.
I was looking at my file cabinets one day, wondering what was in them, and I said, well, it's all the notes I've taken of meetings with Chinese leaders. Wouldn't that be an interesting data set to use to try to describe how Chinese leaders have looked at leadership and governing China over the last 40 years and how they've looked at dealing with the outside world? I wanted to let Chinese leaders speak for themselves. It was idiosyncratic sitting at my desk one day.
There are four men that are pictured on the cover of your book, from Deng Xiaoping all the way up to Xi Jinping. In that period of time, the United States has had maybe, what, 10, 12 presidents. The Chinese leadership has been rather streamlined in that period of time.
Yes, they've had fewer supreme leaders than the comparable number of U.S. presidents. But China's got a very elaborate bureaucracy, both a party bureaucracy, a state bureaucracy, and, of course, a military bureaucracy. And so that's not to mention the leaders at provinces. You've got 31 provinces, and those provinces are as big as countries in many cases. And then China's got 2,000-plus counties, and counties are actually rather large areas. When I, in the book, talk about leaders, I don't mean just the Standing Committee, the Politburo, the party elite, or the Central Committee. I also mean university presidents and county magistrates and provincial governors and party secretaries, and increasingly CEOs in global companies and even NGO leaders. So what is reasonably called a leader today, I think, is a much broader and maybe more more interesting and certainly more diverse, younger group than what were constituted leaders when I began going to China in 1976.
Does the political system in China try to select or groom its leaders to be a certain type, or how much individuality do they really allow as these chosen few have risen to the top?
I guess it's testimony to the power of the individual spirit. China has a very rigorous promotion system that certainly by the time people move up, they have lots of experience with different dimensions of lower levels. They go through the standard operating procedure. And so at one level, you would say the system's designed to create a certain uniformity of policy perspective and actual bureaucratic behavior. But what's equally impressive to me is still when you meet these people, they're radically different personalities, as you could probably find in the range of politicians and other leaders in other societies. But like in every other society, sometimes the top doesn't know what it wants. Even though there are tremendous pressures for conformity, I think China's leaders at the top see themselves as somewhat weak in dealing with subordinates that are continually going their own way.
From Deng Xiaoping to Xi Jinping, how has that dynamic changed in terms of the influence of all of these leaders influencing the person at the top and the top person influencing those under him?
Broadly speaking, Chinese society has become more complicated. The Chinese bureaucracies become more fragmented, complex, and divided. People at the bottom of the system have information and resources and organizations that they run that give them the capacity to more effectively resist upper levels, if that's what they choose to do. While China's leaders are still, by any fair stretch at the top, very powerful and can certainly exercise their power in ways that are either perceived as fair or not fair, nonetheless, I think Chinese leaders now have to negotiate with each other to a much greater extent, and they have to negotiate with society. This has been a dramatic change in the political system. And so the future question, really, it seems for me, is how do we bring a more complex society into a harmonious and effective relationship with what you might call older political institutions?
The Chinese leadership really is now sort of playing into the Western mode of politics, if you will, and having to go to the people and be more visible, be more personable.
Yeah.
It has pushed some people and watchers to say that China is moving toward a democracy. Would that fact alone really be an impetus for China to change that dramatically in its political system?
Yes, I think your question suggests what I think is an important development. But that is that what we've developed is what you might call a responsive authoritarian system. You wouldn't say Mao Zedong was very responsive either to the complaints of his fellow leaders or to the rest of society. He could pretty well ignore both if he was committed to something. I think now China's leaders are much more sensitive, and often they try to preemptively accommodate things. Also, widespread use of public opinion polls now. The party polling on what promotion of which officials might be most acceptable to people. Now it's within the party and it's a closed process. And in the end, the party decides. So I'm not arguing this is democracy, as many Westerners would think. But it is at least somewhat responsive, and it's certainly different than the system was under Mao. We ought to have a rather open mind about the exact course China pursues to accomplish that.
David Lampton, professor of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies at CICE. His book, Following the Leader, Ruling China from Deng Xiaoping to Xi Jinping, is published by the University of California Press. We're going to follow the leader of the latest world news. Steve Norman is up next with International Edition. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese.
and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition. With this application, you can get the latest news and radio and TV programs in Chinese. It also lets you transfer photos and video directly to Washington. Go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA.